This is Audible.
Caiaphas Cain, For the Emperor, by Sandy Mitchell. Read by Stephen Perring, Penelope Rawlins, and Emma Gregory.
Editorial note. What, for want of a better phrase, I will henceforth be referring to as the Cain Archive is, in truth, barely deserving of so grandiloquent a title. It consists merely of a single data slate, stuffed full of files arranged with a cavalier disregard for chronology, and to no scheme of indexing that I've been able to determine, despite prolonged examination of the contents. What can be stated with absolute certainty, however, is that the author was none other than the celebrated Commissar Caiaphas Cain, and that the archive was written by him during his retirement while serving as a tutor at the Schola Progenium. This would pin the date of composition to some time after his appointment to the faculty in 993.M41. From occasional references to his published memoirs, To Serve the Emperor, A Commissar's Life, which first saw the light of day in 005.M42, we can safely conclude that he was inspired by the process of writing them to embark on a fuller account of his experiences, and that the bulk of the archive was composed no earlier than this. His motives for so doing we can only guess at, since publication would have been impossible. Indeed, I placed them under inquisitorial seal the moment they came to light, for reasons which should be immediately apparent to any attentive reader. Nevertheless, I believe they are worthy of further study. Some of my fellow inquisitors may be shocked to discover that one of the Imperium's most venerated heroes was, by his own admission, a scoundrel and self-seeking rogue. A fact which, due to our sporadic personal association, I have long been aware. Indeed, I would go so far as to contend that it was this very combination of character flaws which made him one of the most effective servants the Imperium has ever had, despite his strenuous efforts to the contrary. For, in his century or more of active service to the Commissariat, and occasional less visible activities at my behest, he faced and bested almost every enemy of humanity. Necrons, Tau, Tyranids, and Orcs, Eldar, both free of taint and corrupted by the ruinous powers, and the demonic agents of those powers themselves. Reluctantly, it must be admitted, but in many cases repeatedly, and always with success. A record few, if any, more noble men can equal. In fairness, it should also be pointed out here that Cain is his own harshest critic, often going out of his way to deny that the many instances in which he appears, despite his professed baser motives, to have acted primarily out of loyalty and altruism, were any such thing. It would be ironic, indeed, if his awareness of his shortcomings should have blinded him to his own, admittedly often well-hidden, virtues. It is also worth reflecting that if, as is often asserted, courage consists not of the absence of fear, but the overcoming of it, Cain does indeed richly deserve his heroic reputation, even if he always steadfastly denied the fact. However much we may deplore his professed moral shortcomings, his successes are undeniable, and we can be thankful that Cain's own account of his checkered career has at last been discovered. To say the least, these memoirs shed new light on many of the odder corners of recent imperial history, and his eyewitness accounts of our enemies contain many valuable, if idiosyncratic, insights into understanding and confounding their dark designs. It is for this reason that I preserved the archive and have spent a considerable amount of leisure time in the years since its discovery editing and annotating it, in an attempt to make it more accessible to those of my fellow inquisitors who may wish to peruse it for themselves. Cain appears to have no overall structure in mind, simply recording incidents from his past as they occurred to him, and, as a result, many of the anecdotes are devoid of context. He has a disconcerting habit of beginning in media res, and many of the shorter fragments end abruptly, as his own part in the events he is describing comes to a conclusion. I have therefore chosen to begin the process of dissemination with his account of the Gravelax campaign, which is reasonably coherent, and with which the members of our Ordo will be at least passingly familiar as a result of my own involvement in the affair. Indeed, it contains an account of our first meeting from Cain's perspective, which I must admit I found rather amusing when I first stumbled across it. For the most part, the archive speaks for itself, although I have taken the liberty of breaking up the long and unstructured account into relatively self-contained chapters to facilitate reading. The quotations preceding them are something of an indulgence on my part, having been culled from a collection of such sayings compiled by Cain himself for the apparent amusement and edification of the cadets in his charge. But I justify this as perhaps providing an additional insight into the workings of his mind. Apart from this, I have confined myself to occasional editorial interpolations where I considered it necessary to place Cain's somewhat self-centered narrative into a wider context. Unless otherwise attributed, all such annotations are my own, and I have been otherwise content to let his own words do the work. Amberley Vale, Ordo Xenos.
Chapter 1. I don't know what effect they have on the enemy, but by the Emperor they frighten me. General Karras of the Valhallans, under his command. One of the first things you learn as a commissar is that people are never pleased to see you. Something that's no longer the case where I'm concerned, of course, now that my glorious and undeserved reputation precedes me wherever I go. A good rule of thumb in my younger days, but I'd never found myself staring down death in the eyes of the troopers I was supposed to be inspiring with loyalty to the Emperor before. In my early years, as an occasionally loyal minion of His Glorious Majesty, I'd faced, or to be more accurate, ran away screaming from orcs, necrons, tyrannids, and a severely hacked-off demon host, just to pick out some of the highlights of my ignominious career. But standing in that mess room, a heartbeat away from being ripped apart by mutinous guardsmen, was a unique experience, and one that I have no wish to repeat. I should have realized how bad the situation was when the commanding officer of my new regiment actually smiled at me as I stepped off the shuttle. I already had every reason to fear the worst, of course, but by that time I was out of options. Paradoxical as it might seem, taking this miserable assignment had looked uncomfortably like the best chance I had of keeping my precious skin in one piece. The problem, of course, was my undeserved reputation for heroism, which by that time had grown to such ludicrous proportions that the commissariat had finally noticed me, and decided that my talents were being wasted in the artillery unit I'd picked as the safest place to sit out my lifetime of service to the Emperor, a long way away from the sharp end of combat. Accordingly, I'd found myself plucked from a position of relative obscurity and attached directly to brigade headquarters. That hadn't seemed too bad at first, as I'd had little to do except shuffle data files and organize the occasional firing squad, which had suited me fine. But the trouble with everybody thinking you're a hero is that they tend to assume you like being in mortal danger and go out of their way to provide some. In the half-dozen years since my arrival, I'd been temporarily seconded to units assigned, among other things, to assault fixed positions, clear out a space hulk, and run recon deep behind enemy lines. and every time I'd made it back alive, due in no small part to my natural talent for diving for cover and waiting for the noise to stop, the general staff had patted me on the head, given me another commendation, and tried to find an even more inventive way of getting me killed. Something obviously had to be done, and done fast, before my luck ran out altogether. So, as I often had before, I let my reputation do the work for me and put in a request for a transfer back to a regiment. Any regiment. By that time I just didn't care. Long experience had taught me that the opportunities for taking care of my own neck were much higher when I could pull rank on every officer around me. "I just don't think I'm cut out for data shuffling," I said apologetically to the weasel-faced little runt from the Lord General's office. He nodded judiciously and made a show of paging through my file.
"I can't say I'm surprised," he said in a
slightly nasal whine. Although he tried to look cool and composed, his body language betrayed his excitement at being in the presence of a living legend. At least that's what some damn fool Pictcast commentator had called me after the Siege of Perlia, and the appellation stuck. The next thing I know, my own face is grinning at me from recruiting posters all over the sector, and I couldn't even grab a mug of recaf without having a piece of paper shoved under my nose with a request to autograph it.
"It doesn't suit everybody."
"It's a shame we can't all have your dedication to the smooth running of the Imperium," I said. He looked sharply at me for a moment, wondering if I was taking the frack, which of course I was, then decided I was simply being civil. I decided to ladle it on a bit. But I'm afraid I've been a soldier too long to start changing my habits now. That was the sort of thing Kane the Hero was supposed to say, of course, and Weaselface lapped it up. He took my transfer request from me as though it was a relic from one of the blessed saints.
"I'll handle it personally," he said,
practically bowing as he showed me out. And so it was a month or so later. I found myself in a shuttle approaching the hangar bay of the Righteous Wrath, a battered old troop ship identical to thousands in Imperial service, almost all of which I sometimes think I've travelled on over the years. The familiar smell of shipboard air, stale, recycled, inextricably intertwined with rancid sweat, machine oil and boiled cabbage, hissed into the passenger compartment as the hatch seals opened. I inhaled it gratefully, as it displaced the no less familiar odour of Gunnar Jürgen, my aide, almost since the outset of my commissarial career, nearly 20 years before. Short for a Valhallan, Jürgen somehow managed to look awkward and out of place wherever he was, and in all our time together, I couldn't recall a single occasion on which he'd ever worn anything that appeared to fit properly. Though amiable enough in temperament, he seemed ill at ease with people, and in turn, most preferred to avoid his company, a tendency no doubt exacerbated by the perpetual psoriasis that affected him, as well as his body odour, which, in all honesty, took quite a bit of getting used to. Nevertheless, he'd proven an able and valued aide, due in no small part to his peculiar mentality. Not overly bright, but eager to please and doggedly literal in his approach to following orders, he'd become a useful buffer between me and some of the more onerous aspects of my job. He never questioned anything I said or did, apparently convinced that it must be for the good of the Imperium in some way, which, given the occasionally discreditable activities I'd been known to indulge in, was a great deal more than I could have hoped for from any other trooper. Even after all this time, I still find myself missing him on occasion. So he was right there at my side, half hidden by our combined luggage, which he'd somehow contrived to gather up and hold, despite the weight, as my boot heels first rang on the deck plating beneath the shuttle. I didn't object. Experience had taught me that it was a good idea for people meeting him for the first time to get the full picture in increments. I paused fractionally for dramatic effect before striding forward to meet the small knot of guard officers drawn up to greet me by the main cargo doors, the clang of my footsteps on the metal sounding as crisp and authoritative as I could contrive, an effect undercut slightly by the pops and clangs from the scorched area under the shuttle engine as it cooled, and Jürgen's tottering gait behind me. "Welcome, Commissar. This is a great honour." A surprisingly young woman with red hair and blue eyes stepped forward and snapped a crisp salute with parade ground efficiency. I thought for a moment that I was being subtly snubbed with only the junior officers present before I reconciled her face with the file picture in the briefing slate. I returned the salute. "Colonel Castine," I nodded an acknowledgement. Despite having no objection to being fawned over by young women in the normal course of events, I found such a transparent attempt at ingratiation a little nauseating. Then I got a good look at her hopeful expression and felt as though I'd stepped on a non-existent final stair. She was absolutely sincere. "Emperor, help me, they really were pleased to see me." Things must be even worse here than I'd imagined. Just how bad they actually were I had yet to discover, but I already had some presentiment. For one thing, the palms of my hands were tingling, which always means there's trouble hanging in the air like the static before a storm. And for another, I'd broken with the habit of a lifetime and actually read the briefing slate carefully on the tedious voyage out here to meet the ship. To cut a long story short, morale in the Valhallan 296/301st was at rock bottom, and the root cause of it all was obvious from the regiment's title. Combining below-strength regiments was standard practice among the Imperial Guard, a sensible way of consolidating after combat losses to keep units up to strength and of further use in the field. What hadn't been sensible was combining what was left of the 301st, a crack planetary assault unit with 1,500 years of traditional belief in their innate superiority over every other unit in the Guard, particularly the other Valhallan ones, with the 296th, a rear echelon garrison command, which, just to throw promethium on the flames, was one of the few all-women regiments raised and maintained by that desolate iceball. And just to put the cherry on it, Castine had been given overall command by virtue of 3 days' seniority over her new immediate subordinate, a man with far more combat experience. Not that any of them truly lacked that now, after the battle for Corania. The Tyranids had attacked without warning, and every Guard regiment on the planet had been forced to resist ferociously for nearly a year before the Navy and a couple of Astartes chapters had arrived to turn the tide.
A common mistake. It is, of course, virtually unheard of for an entire Astartes chapter to take the field at once, let alone two. What Kane obviously means here is that elements from two different chapters were involved, a couple of companies apiece from the Reclaimers and the Swords of the Emperor.
By that time, every surviving unit had sustained at least 50% casualties, many of them a great deal more, and the bureaucrats of the Munitorium had begun the process of consolidating the battered survivors into useful units once again. On paper, at least. No one with any practical military experience would have been so half-witted as to ignore the morale effects of their decisions. But that's bureaucrats for you. Maybe if a few more administratum drones were given lasguns and told to soldier alongside the troopers for a month or two, it would shake their ideas up a bit, assuming by some miracle they weren't shot in the back on the first day, of course. But I'm digressing. I returned Castine's salute, noting as I did so the faint discoloration of the fabric beneath her rank insignia where her captain's studs had been before her recent unanticipated elevation to colonel. There had been few officers left in either regiment by the time the Nids had got through with them, and they'd been lucky at that. At least one of the newly consolidated units was being led by a former corporal, or so I'd heard.
He'd heard wrong, or is possibly exaggerating for effect. The newly appointed colonel of the 112th Rough Riders was a former sergeant, true, but had already received a battlefield promotion to lieutenant during the defence of Corania. None of the senior command staff in any of the recently consolidated units had made the promotional jump directly from non-commissioned officer.
Unfortunately, neither of their commissars had survived so. Thanks to my fortuitously timed transfer request, I'd been handed the job of sorting out the mess. Lucky me. Major Brooklaw, my second in command. Castine introduced the man next to her, his own insignia equally new. His face flushed almost imperceptibly, but he stepped forward to shake my hand with a firm grip. His eyes were flint grey beneath his dark fringe of hair, and he closed his hand a little too tightly, trying to gauge my strength. Two could play at that game, of course, and I had the advantage of a couple of augmetic fingers, so I returned the favour, smiling blandly as the colour drained from his face. "Major!" I let him go before anything was damaged except his pride, and turned to the next officer in line. Castine had rounded up pretty much her entire senior command staff, as protocol demanded, but it was clear most of them weren't too sure about having me around. Only a few met my eyes, but the legend of Kane the Hero had arrived here before me, and the ones that did were obviously hoping I'd be able to turn around a situation they all patently felt had gone way beyond their own ability to deal with. I don't know what the rest were thinking. They were probably just relieved I wasn't talking about shooting the lot of them and bringing in somebody competent. Of course, if that had been a realistic option, I might have considered it, but I had an unwanted reputation for honesty and fairness to live up to, so that was that. The introductions over, I turned back to Castine and indicated the tottering pile of kit bags behind me. Her eyes widened fractionally as she caught a glimpse of Jürgen's face behind the barricade, but I suppose anyone who'd gone hand-to-hand with Tyranids would have found the experience relatively unperturbing, and she masked it quickly. Most of the assembled officers, I noted with well-concealed amusement, were now breathing shallowly through their mouths. "My aide, Gunner First Class Ferrik Jürgen," I said. In truth, there was only one grade of gunner, but I didn't expect they'd know that, and the small unofficial promotion would add to whatever kudos he got from being the aide of a commissar, which in turn would reflect well on me. "Perhaps you could assign him some quarters." "Of course." She turned to one of the youngest lieutenants, a blonde girl of vaguely equine appearance who looked as if she'd been more at home on a farm somewhere than in uniform, and nodded. "Sulla, get the quartermaster to sort it out." "I'll do it myself," she replied, slightly overdoing the eager young officer routine. "Matchell's doing his best, but he's not quite on top of the system yet." Castine nodded blandly, unaware of any problem, but I could see Brocklaw's jaw tighten and noticed that most of the men present failed to mask their displeasure. "Sulla was our quartermaster sergeant until the last round of promotions," Castine explained. "She knows the ship's resources better than anyone." "I'm sure she does," I said diplomatically. "And I'm sure she has far more pressing duties to perform than finding a bunk for Jürgen. We'll liaise with your Sergeant Magill ourselves, if you have no objection." "None at all." Castine looked slightly puzzled for a moment, then dismissed it. Brocklaw, I noticed from the corner of my eye, was looking at me with something approaching respect now. Well, that was something at least. But it was pretty clear I was going to have my work cut out to turn this divided and demoralized rabble into anything resembling a fighting unit. Well, up to a point, anyway. If they were a long way from being ready to fight the enemies of the Emperor, they were certainly in good enough shape to fight amongst themselves, as I was shortly to discover. I haven't reached my second century by ignoring the little presentiments of trouble which sometimes appear out of nowhere, like those itching palms of mine, or the little voice in the back of my head which tells me something seems too good to be true. But in my first few days aboard the Righteous Wrath, I had no need of such subtle promptings from my subconscious. Tension hung in the air of the corridors assigned to us like ozone around a demon host, all but striking sparks from the bulkheads. And I wasn't the only one to feel it. None of the other regiments on board would venture into our part of the ship, either for social interaction or the time-honored tradition of perpetrating practical jokes against the members of another unit. The naval provosts patrolled in tense, wary groups, desperate for some kind of respite. I even made courtesy calls on the other commissars aboard, but these were far from convivial. Humorless emperor botherers to a man. The younger ones were too overwhelmed by respect for my reputation to be good company, and most of the older ones were quietly resentful of what they saw as a glory-hogging young upstart. Tedious as these interludes were, though, I was to be grateful for them sooner than I thought. The one bright spot was Captain Pargita, who'd commanded the vessel for the past 30 years, and with whom I hit it off from our first dinner together. I'm sure he only invited me the first time because protocol demanded it, and perhaps out of curiosity to see what a hero of the Imperium actually looked like in the flesh. But by the time we were halfway through the first course, we were chatting away like old friends. I told a few outrageous lies about my past adventures, and he reciprocated with some anecdotes of his own. And by the time we'd got on to the Amasek, I felt more relaxed than I had in months. For one thing, he really appreciated the problems I was facing with Castine and her rabble. "You need to reassert some discipline," he told me unnecessarily, "before the rot spreads any further. Shoot a few. That'll buck their ideas up." Easy to say, of course, but not so easy in practice. That's what most commissars would have done, admittedly. But getting a regiment united because they're terrified of you and hate your guts has its own drawbacks, particularly as you're going to find yourself in the middle of a battlefield with these people before very long. And they'll all have guns. And, as I've already said, I had a reputation to maintain. And a good part of that was keeping up the pretense that I actually gave a damn about the troopers under my command. So, not an option, unfortunately. It was while I was on my way back to my quarters from one such pleasant evening that my hand was forced, and in a way I could well have done without. It was the noise that alerted me at first, a gradually swelling babble of voices from the corridors leading to our section of the ship. My pleasantly reflective mood, enhanced by Parjita's Amasek and a comfortable win over the regicide board, evaporated in an instant. I knew that sound all too well, and the clatter of boots on the deck behind me as a squad of provosts double-timed towards the disturbance with shock buttons drawn was enough to confirm it. I picked up my pace to join them, falling in beside the section leader. "Sounds like a riot," I said. The blank-visored head nodded.
"Quite right, sir."
"Any idea what sparked it?" Not that it mattered. The simmering resentment among the Valhallans was almost cause enough on its own. Any excuse would have done. If he did have a clue, I never got to hear it. As we arrived at the door of the mess hall, a ceramic cup bearing the regimental crest of the 296th shattered against his helmet. "Emperor's blood!" I ducked reflexively, taking cover behind the nearest piece of furniture to assess the situation while the provosts waded in ahead of me, striking out with their shock batons at any target that presented itself. The room was a heaving mass of angry men and women, punching, kicking, and flailing at one another. All semblance of discipline shot to hell. Several were down already, bleeding, screaming, being trampled on by the still-active combatants, and the casualties were rising all the time. The fiercest fighting was going on in the centre of the room, a small knot of brawlers, clearly intent on actual murder unless someone intervened. Fine by me. That's what the provosts were for. I hunkered down behind an overturned table, scanning the room as I voxed a situation report to Castine and watched them battle their way forward. The two fighters at the centre of the melee seemed evenly matched to me. A shaven-headed man, muscled like a catechan, who towered over a wiry young woman with short-cropped raven-black hair. Whatever advantage he had in strength, she could match in agility, striking hard and leaping back out of range, reducing most of his strikes to glancing blows, which is just as well, as a clean hit from those ham-like fists would likely have stove her ribcage in. As I watched, he spun, launching a lethal roundhouse kick to her temple. She ducked, just a fraction slow, and went sprawling as his foot grazed the top of her head, but twisted upright again with a knife from one of the tables in her hand. The blow came upwards towards his sternum, but he blocked it, opening up a livid red gash along his right arm. It was about then that things really started to go wrong. The provosts had made it almost halfway to the brawl I was watching, when the two sides finally realized they had an enemy in common. A young woman, blood pouring from a broken nose, was unceremoniously yanked away from the man whose groin she'd been aiming a kick at and rounded on the provost, attempting to restrain her. Her elbow strike bounced harmlessly off his torso armour, but her erstwhile opponent leapt to her defence, swinging a broken plate in a short clinical arc which impacted precisely on the neck joint where helmet met flak. A bright crimson spurt of arterial blood sprayed the surrounding bystanders as the stricken provost dropped to his knees, trying to stem the bleeding. Emperor's bowels!
I began to edge my way back towards the door to wait for the reinforcements Castine had promised. If they hadn't been before, the mob was in a killing mood now, and anyone who looked like a symbol of authority would become an obvious target. Even as I watched, both factions turned on the provosts in their midst, who disappeared under a swarm of bodies. The troopers barely seemed human anymore. I'd seen Tyranids move like that in response to a perceived threat, but this was even worse. Your average Nidswarm has purpose and intelligence behind everything it does, even though it's hard to remember that when a tidal wave of chitin is bearing down on you with every intention of reducing you to mincemeat. But it was clear that there was no intelligence working here, just sheer brute bloodlust. Emperor, damn it, I've seen cornate cults with more self-restraint than those supposedly disciplined guard troopers displayed in that mess hall. At least while they were ripping the provost apart, they weren't likely to notice me. So I made what progress I could towards the door, ready to take command of the reinforcements as soon as they arrived. And I would have made it too, if the squad leader hadn't surfaced long enough to scream, "Commissar, help!" Oh, great. Every pair of eyes in the room suddenly swung in my direction. I thought I could see my reflection in every pupil, tracking me like an Auspex. "If you take one more step towards that door," I told myself, "you're a dead man." They'd be on me in seconds. The only way to survive was to take them by surprise. So I stepped forward instead, as though I'd just entered the room. "You," I pointed at a random trooper, "get a broom." Whatever they'd been expecting me to say or do, this definitely wasn't it. The room hung suspended in confused anticipation, the silence stretching for an infinite second. No one moved. "That was not a request," I said, raising my voice a little and taking another step forward. "This mess hall is an absolute disgrace, and no one is leaving until it's been tidied up." My boot skidded in a slowly congealing pool of blood. You and you, go with him. Buckets and mops. Make sure you get enough to go round." Confusion and uncertainty began to spread. Troopers flicking nervous glances at one another as it gradually began to dawn on them that the situation had got well out of hand and that consequences had to be faced. The guardsmen I'd pointed out, two of them women, began to edge nervously towards the door. "At the double!" I barked suddenly. With my best parade ground snap, the designated troopers scurried out, ingrained patterns of discipline reasserting themselves. And that was enough. The thunderstorm crackle of violence dissipated from the room as though suddenly earthed. After that, it was easy. Now that I'd asserted my authority, the rest fell into line as meek as you please, and by the time Castine arrived with another squad of provosts in tow, I'd already detailed a few more to escort the wounded and worse to the infirmary. A surprising number were able to walk, but there were still far too many stretcher cases for my liking. "You did well, I hear." Castine was at my elbow, her face pale as she surveyed the damage. I shrugged, knowing from long experience that credit snowballs all the faster the less you seem to want it. "Not well enough for some of these poor souls," I said. "Bravest thing I ever saw," I heard from behind me, as one of the injured provosts was helped away by a couple of his shipmates. "He just stood there and faced them down, the whole damn lot." His voice faded, adding another small increment to my heroic reputation, which I knew would be all round the ship by this time tomorrow. "There'll have to be an investigation." Castine looked stunned, still not quite capable of taking in the full enormity of what had happened. "We need to know who started it, what happened." "Who's to blame?" Brocklaw cut in from the door. It was obvious from the direction of his gaze where he thought the responsibility should lie. Castine flushed. "I've no doubt we'll discover the men responsible," she said, a faint but perceptible stress on the pronoun. Brocklaw refused to rise to the bait. "We can all thank the Emperor we have an impartial adjudicator in the Commissar here,"
he said smoothly. I'm sure we can rely on him to sort it out. Thanks a lot, I thought. But he was right, and how I handled it was to determine the rest of my future with the regiment, not to mention leaving me running for my life yet again, beginning a long and unwelcome association with the Emperor's pet psychopaths, and an encounter with the most fascinating woman I've ever met.
Not the most flattering or accurate description of His Divine Majesty's Most Holy Inquisition, it must be admitted.
Chapter 2. You get more with a kind word and an excruciator than with just a kind word. Inquisitor Mulden. So, what you're trying to tell me, I said, turning the piece of crockery over in my hand, is that 3 people are dead, 14 still in the infirmary, and a perfectly serviceable mess hall reduced to kindling because your men didn't like the plates they were served their meal on. Brocklaw squirmed visibly on one of the chairs I had Jürgen bring into my office for the conference. I told him to fetch the most uncomfortable ones he could find, as every little bit helps when you're trying to exert your authority. But the Major's discomfiture wasn't due to just that alone. Castine was still visibly suppressing a smirk, which I was planning to wipe away in a moment.
"Well, that may be overstating it a little," he began.
"That's precisely what happened," Castine cut in acidly. I hefted the plate. It was good quality porcelain, delicate but strong, and one of the few pieces remaining intact after the mess hall riot. The regimental crest of the 296th was prominent in the centre of it. I turned to the data slate on my desk and made a show of paging through the reports and witness statements I'd spent the past week collecting. According to this witness statement, the first punch was swung by a Corporal Bella Trebek, a member of the 296th prior to the amalgamation. I raised an inquisitive eyebrow in Castine's direction. Would the Colonel care to comment? She was clearly provoked, Castine said, losing the smirk, which seemed to hover in the air for a moment before jumping across to Brocklaw. Just so, I nodded judiciously, by a Sergeant Tobias Kelp, who, it says here, threw his plate down, declaring that he would be damned if he ate off some... I made a show of getting the quotation scrupulously correct. Mincing Tarts Front Parlour Tea Service. Does that strike you as a reasonable comment, Major? The smirk disappeared again. Not particularly, no, he said, clearly wondering where this line of questioning was going. But we still don't know the full circumstances.
I think the circumstances are perfectly clear, I said.
The former troopers of the 296th and the 301st have cordially detested one another since the regiments were amalgamated. Under the circumstances, the use of the 296th's regimental dinner service was bound to be regarded as an insult by the stupider elements of the former 301st. Brocklaw flushed at that. Good. Let him get angry. The only way to salvage the situation was to make radical changes, and that wouldn't work unless I could get the senior officers to feel passionately that they were necessary. Which begs another question, I went on smoothly. Just who was stupid enough to order the use of the dinner service in the first place? I aimed my second best intimidating commissarial glare at Castine for a fraction of a second before snapping it round to nail the junior officer sitting at her right. Lieutenant Sulla, that would be you, would it not?
It was Founding Day, she retorted.
That did take me by surprise. I didn't often get people bouncing back from a number two glare, but I concealed it with the ease of long practice. We always use the regimental ceramics on Founding Day. It's one of our proudest traditions.
It was, Brocklaw broke in with sardonic amusement. But unless you've got some traditional adhesive...
Both women bristled. For a moment, I thought I was going to have to put down a brawl in my own office.
Major, I said, reasserting my authority. I'm sure the 301st had their own Founding Day traditions. That was a pretty safe bet, as practically every regiment celebrated the anniversary of its first founding in some way. He began to nod, before my use of the past tense registered with him, and then an expression curiously close to apprehension flickered across his face. I leaned back in my chair, which, unlike theirs, I'd made sure was comfortably padded, and looked approving. It's always good to keep people off balance. I'm glad to hear it. Such traditions are important. A vital part of the esprit de corps we all rely on to win the Emperor his victories. Castine and Brocklaw nodded cautiously, almost together. Good. That was the one thing at least they could agree on. But Sula just flushed angrily.
Then perhaps you could explain that to Kelp and his knuckle-draggers, she said.
I sighed, tolerantly, and placed my las pistol on the desk. The officer's eyes widened slightly. Brocklaw's took on a wary expression, Castine's one of barely suppressed alarm, and Sula's jaw dropped open.
"Please don't interrupt, Lieutenant," I said mildly.
"You can all have your say in a moment."
There was a definite edge in the room now. I had no intention of shooting anyone, of course, but they weren't going to like what I was about to say next, and you can't be too careful.
I smiled to show I was harmless, and they relaxed a fraction.
Nevertheless, you've just illustrated my point perfectly. While the two halves of this regiment still think of themselves as separate units, morale is never going to recover. That means you're sod-all use to the Emperor and a pain in the ass to me. I paused, just long enough to let them assimilate what I'd just said. Are we in agreement on that, at least?
Castine nodded, meeting Brocklaw's eyes for the first time since the meeting began.
I think so, she said. The question is, what do we do about it?
Good question. I passed a slate across the desk. She took it, and Brocklaw leaned in to scan it over her shoulder as she read.
We can start by integrating the units at squad level. As of this morning, every squad will consist of roughly equal numbers of troopers from each of the former regiments.
That's ridiculous, Brocklaw snapped, a fraction behind Castine's far from ladylike exclamation.
The men won't stand for it.
Neither will my women.
Castine nodded in agreement with him.
So far, so good. Making them feel they had common cause against me was the first step to getting them to cooperate properly.
They're going to have to, I said. This ship is en route to a potential war zone. We could be in combat within hours of our arrival, and when that happens, they'll have to rely on the trooper next to them, whoever it is. I don't want my people getting killed because they don't trust their own comrades. So they're going to train together and work together until they start behaving like an Imperial Guard regiment instead of a bunch of pre-scholar juvies. And they're going to fight the Emperor's enemies together, and I expect them to win. Is that clear?
Perfectly, Commissar. Castine's jaw was tight. I'll start reviewing the SO&E.
Slate of organization and equipment. Not actually a physical data slate, but an archaic term for the details of the disposition of troopers and equipment within an Imperial Guard unit, still in use among many regiments, with more than 1,000 years of unbroken tradition.
Perhaps it would be best if you did so with the Major's help, I suggested. Between you, you should be able to select fire teams which at least have a reasonable chance of turning their lasguns on the enemy instead of one another.
Of course, Brocklaw nodded. I'll be pleased to help.
The tone of his voice said otherwise, but at least the words were conciliatory. That was a start. But they really weren't going to like what was coming next.
Which brings me on to the new regimental designation. I'd been expecting some outburst at this, but the trio of officers in front of me just stared in stupefied silence. I guess they were trying to convince themselves they hadn't heard what I'd just said. The current one just emphasizes the divisions between what used to be the 301st and the 296th. We need a new one, ladies and gentlemen. A single identity under which we can march into battle united and resolute as true servants of the Emperor. All good stirring stuff, and for a moment I actually thought they were going to buy it without any further argument. But of course it was that daft Mayor Sula who burst the bubble.
"You can't just abolish the 296th," she almost shouted. "Our battle honours go back centuries. If you count slapping down stroppy colonists as battles," Brocklaw rose to the bait, "the 301st has fought Orcs, Eldar, Tyranids."
"Oh, there were Tyranids on Karania. I guess I was just too busy with my needlepoint to notice."
Sula's voice rose another octave.
"Shut up, both of you."
Castine's voice was quiet but firm and stunned both her subordinates into silence. I nodded gratefully at her, forestalled from having to do the job myself, and pleasantly surprised. It was beginning to look as though she had the makings of an effective commander after all. "Let's hear what the Commissar has to say before we start inventing objections to it."
"Thank you, Colonel," I said before resuming. "What I propose is to treat the date of amalgamation as a new first founding. I've had the ship's astropath contact the Munitorium, and they've agreed in principle. There is currently no regiment designated the Valhallan 597th, so I've proposed adopting that as our new identity."
296 plus 301. "I see," Castine nodded. "Very clever."
Brocklaw nodded too.
A very neat way of preserving the identities of the old regiments," he said, "but combined into something new."
"As was always the intention," I agreed.
"But that's outrageous," Sula said. "You can't just redesignate an entire regiment out of existence."
"The Commissariat gives its servants wide discretionary powers," I said mildly. "How we interpret them is a matter of judgment, and sometimes temperament. Not every Commissar would have resisted the temptation to discourage further dissension in the ranks by decimation, for instance. Quite true, of course. There were damn few who'd go quite so far as to randomly execute 1 in 10 of the troopers under their command to encourage the others, but they did exist. And if ever a regiment was so undisciplined that such a drastic measure might have been justified, it was this one, and they knew it. They were just lucky they'd got Kane the Hero instead of some gung-ho psychopath. I've met one or two in my time, and the best thing you can say for them is that they don't tend to be around long, particularly once the shooting starts." I smiled to show I didn't mean it. "If the new designation is unacceptable," I added, "the 48th Penal Legion is also available, I'm told." Sula blenched. Castine smiled tightly, unsure of how serious I was.
"The 597th sounds good to me," she said.
"Major Brocklaw?"
"An excellent compromise."
He nodded slowly, letting the idea percolate.
"There'll be some grumbling in the ranks, but if ever a regiment needed a new beginning, it's this one."
"Amen to that," Castine agreed. The two senior officers looked at one another with renewed respect. That was a good sign, too. Only Sula still looked unhappy. Brocklaw noticed and caught her eye.
"Cheer up, Lieutenant," he said. "That would make our next founding day..."
He paused fractionally, glancing at me for confirmation as he worked it out. 258. I nodded.
"You'll have nearly 8 months to come up with some brand new traditions." Of course, the changes I'd imposed didn't go down too well with the rank and file, at least to begin with, and I got most of the blame. But then I've never expected to be popular. Ever since I got selected for commissarial training, I've known I could expect very little from the troopers around me, apart from resentment and suspicion. As my undeserved reputation has snowballed, of course, that's got to be the case less and less of the time, but back then I was still taking it more or less for granted. Gradually, though, the reorganization I'd insisted on began to work, and the training exercises we put the troopers through were beginning to make them think like soldiers again. I instituted a weekly prize of an afternoon's downtime for the most efficient platoon in the regiment, and a doubling of the ale rations for the members of the most disciplined squad within it, and that helped remarkably.
I felt we'd really turned a corner the morning I overheard one of the new mixed squads chatting together in the freshly repainted mess hall, instead of splitting it into two separate groups as they tended to do in the beginning, and exulting over their higher place in the rankings than a rival platoon. These days, I'm told, Kane's Round is a cherished tradition in the 597th, and the competition for the extra ration of ale still hotly contested. All in all, I suppose there are worse things to be remembered for. The one problem we still had to resolve, of course, was the matter of those responsible for the riots in the first place. Kelp and Trebek were for it. There was no doubt about that, along with a handful of others who had been positively identified as responsible for the worst of the deaths and injuries. But for the time being, I'd put off the question of punishment. The wholesale reforms I'd instigated and the subsequent improvement in morale were still fragile, and I didn't dare risk it by ordering executions. So I did what any sensible man in my position would have done. Dragged my feet under the pretext of carrying out a thorough investigation. Kept the defaulters locked away where, with any luck, most of their comrades would forget about them in the general upheaval and hoped something would turn up. It was a good plan. And it would have worked too, at least until we arrived in a war zone somewhere and I could quietly return them to a unit or have them transferred away with no one any the wiser, if it hadn't been for my good friend Captain Barjita. Technically, of course, he was well within his rights to demand copies of all the reports I'd been compiling, and I hadn't thought there was any harm in letting him have them. What I'd been forgetting was that the Righteous Wrath wasn't just a collection of corridors, bunkrooms, and training bays. It was his ship, and that he was the ultimate authority on board. Two of the dead had been his provosts, after all, and he wasn't about to sit back and let the perpetrators get away with it. He wanted a full court-martial of the guilty troopers while we were still on board, and he could make sure they were punished to his satisfaction. "I know you want to be thorough," he said one evening as we set up the regicide board in his quarters. "But frankly, Caiaphas, I think you're overdoing it. You already know who the guilty parties are. Just shoot them and have done with it." I shook my head regretfully. "But what would that solve?" I asked. "Would it bring your men back to life?" "Oh, that's not the point." He held out both fists, concealing playing pieces. I picked the left and found I was playing blue. A minor tactical disadvantage, but one I was sure I could overcome. Regicide isn't really my game, to be honest. Give me a tarot deck and a table full of suckers with more money than sense any day, but it passed the time pleasantly enough. There really can't be any other verdict, and every day you delay just leaves the cowardly scum cluttering up my brig, eating my food, breathing my air. He was getting quite emotional. I began to suspect that there had been more than a simple line of command relationship between him and one of the dead provosts.
Kane is correct in this assumption. Strictly against regulations, of course, but boys will be boys.
Believe me, I said, there's nothing I'd like better than to draw a line under this whole sorry affair. But the situation's complicated. If I have them shot, the whole regiment could unravel again. Morale's just starting to recover. I appreciate that, Pajita nodded, but that's not my problem. I've got a crew to think about, and they want to see their comrades avenged. He made his opening move. I see. I moved one of my own pieces, playing for time in more senses than one. Then it's clearly long past time that justice was served. Are you insane? Castine asked, looking at me across the desk and trying to ignore the hovering presence of Jürgen, who was shuffling some routine reports I couldn't be bothered to deal with. "If you condemn the defaulters now, we'll be right back where we started. Trebek's very popular with the..." She shot a quick glance at Brocklaw, seated next to her, and overrode the remark she'd been about to make. "With some of the troopers." "The same goes for Kelp." Brocklaw moved quickly to back her up. Exactly the reaction I'd been hoping for, now the regiment was beginning to function properly. Castine and Brocklaw had begun to slip into their roles of commander and executive officer as smoothly as if the bad feeling between them had never existed. Well, up to a point, anyway. There was still an air of strained politeness between them occasionally, which betrayed the effort, but they were well on the way. And, to be honest, it was far more than I could have hoped for when I stepped off the shuttle.
"I agree," I said.
"Thank you, Jürgen." My aide had appeared at my shoulder with a pot of Tanner leaf tea, as was his habit whenever I was in my office at this time of the morning. "Could you get another couple of bowls?"
"Of course, Commissar."
He shuffled away as I poured my own drink and pushed the tray to the side of my desk. The warm, aromatic steam relaxed me as it always did.
"Not for me, thank you,"
Brocklaw said hastily as Jürgen returned, a fresh pair of tea bowls pinched together by a grubby finger and thumb on the inside of the rims. Castine blenched slightly, but accepted a drink anyway. She kept it on the desk in front of her, picking it up from time to time to punctuate her side of the conversation, but never quite getting round to taking the first sip. I was quietly impressed. She'd have made a good diplomat if she hadn't been so honest.
"The problem is," I went on, "the Captain Pargita is the ultimate authority aboard this ship, and he's well within his rights to insist on a court-martial. If we don't let him have one, he'll just invoke his command privilege and have Kelp and the others shot anyway, and we simply can't let that happen."
"So what do you suggest?" Castine asked, replacing the tea bowl after another almost sip. "Regimental discipline is supposed to be your responsibility, after all."
"Precisely."
I took a sip of my own tea, savouring the bitter aftertaste, and nodded judiciously. "And I've been able to convince him that I can't have that authority undermined if we're to become a viable fighting unit."
"You've got him to agree to some kind of compromise?" Brocklaw asked, grasping the point at once.
"I have." I tried not to sound too smug.
"He can have his court-martial and run it himself under naval regulations, but once they're found guilty, they'll be turned over to the Commissariat for sentencing."
"But that takes us right back to where we were before," Castine said, clearly puzzled.
"You have them shot and discipline goes to the warp, again."
"Maybe not," I said, taking another sip of tea.
"Not if we're careful."
I've seen more than my fair share of tribunals over the years, even been in front of them on occasion, and if there's one thing I've learned, it's this. It's easy to get the result you want out of them. The trick is simply to state your case as clearly and concisely as possible. That, and making damn sure the members of it are on your side to begin with. There are a number of ways of ensuring that this is the case. Bribery and threats are always popular, but generally to be avoided, especially if you are likely to attract inquisitorial attention, as they're better at both and tend to resent other people resorting to their methods.
This is, of course, entirely untrue. As His Divine Majesty's most faithful servants, we're most definitely above such petty emotions as resentment.
Besides, that sort of thing tends to leave a residue of bad feeling, which can come back to haunt you later on. In my experience, it's far more effective to make sure that the other members of the panel are honest, unimaginative idiots with a strong sense of duty and a stronger set of prejudices you can rely on to deliver the result that you want. If they think you're a hero and hang on your every word, so much the better. So, when Pargita announced his verdict of guilty on all charges and turned to me with a self-satisfied smirk, I had my strategy worked out well in advance. The courtroom, a hastily converted wardroom generally used by the ship's most junior officers, went silent. There were 5 troopers in the dock by the time the trial had begun. Far fewer than Pargita had wanted, but in the interests of fairness and damage limitation, I had managed to persuade him to let me deal summarily with most of the outstanding cases. Those guilty of more minor offences had been demoted, flogged, or assigned to latrine duty for the foreseeable future and safely returned to their units, where, in the unfathomable processes of the trooper's mindset, I had somehow become the embodiment of justice and mercy. This had been helped along by a little judicious myth-making among the senior officers, who had let it be known that Pargita was hell-bent on mass executions and that I had spent the past few weeks exerting every iota of my commissarial authority in urging clemency for the vast majority. finally succeeding against almost impossible odds. The net result, aided no end by my fictitious reputation, was that a couple of dozen potential troublemakers had been quietly integrated back into the roster. Practically grateful for the punishments they'd received, and morale had remained steady among the rank and file.